Broadcast comes from the city of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods, food, and original works of art, located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square, downtown Urbana. Information at 344-2444.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Furness at the controls this morning. This is hour number two of our program. Well, no doubt you have heard the big news out of Washington, D.C. this morning, and that is that Harriet Myers, President Bush's choice to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the U.S. Supreme Court, she has withdrawn her nomination. It proved almost from the very beginning very controversial, as many members of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, questioned whether she was qualified to sit on the Supreme Court. And in fact, many of the nation's most high-profile conservative columnists did more than question whether she was qualified. They came right out and said that she was not. Hearings for her nomination had been scheduled, for her confirmation had been scheduled to start on November 7th. Now that won't happen. In the near future, I'm sure we expect that the Bush administration will announce another choice and the whole process will begin all over again. And when that happens, when the hearings do eventually take place, I think we know what'll happen, because we've seen it happen. We saw it happen with Judge Myers when he was named to replace the Chief Justice, Mr. Rehnquist. We've seen it before with other people who have been nominated for the Supreme Court. They sit down with the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the senators ask the nominee questions, and they ask questions about some of the most controversial hot-button issues of the day in an effort to get the nominee to tell them how they would rule. And then the person who is there sitting in front of them seemingly does their best to answer the question and yet not. Our guest for this part of Focus 580, however, Gerald Rosenberg, and he's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, says that if that happens, as has happened before, we will miss what is really the most important issue at stake, that being not the nominee, whoever that person will be, not their view on hot-button issues. The real fundamental question, and the one that he says doesn't get a whole lot of discussion, is what really is the role of the Supreme Court in American society? We saw a piece that he wrote for the Chicago Tribune not too long ago that caught our eye, that indeed raised this very question, saying, here's an opportunity to talk about this. Chances are it probably won't happen, but it's something that we should talk about. And we thought, well, this would be a good basis for a conversation. And he's been good enough to spend some time here with us this morning. Gerald Rosenberg, he is associate professor of political science and also lecturer in law with interests in both American politics and public law. And the main focus is on the use of courts to further the rights and interests of the disadvantaged, and has authored a book on this subject. It's titled The Hollow Hope: Can Courts Bring About Social Change? He is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Questions, comments, welcome. We only ask people to be brief so that we can keep the program moving. But otherwise, other than that, questions and comments, again, are certainly welcome. Professor Rosenberg, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. It was never our intention for our conversation really to be all about Harriet Myers specifically. Having said that, however, I'm interested in your reaction to how the process played out from the point that her name was announced to this morning when she said that she was withdrawing.
I have a combination of reactions. On the one hand, I'm not surprised, and on the other, I'm stunned. let me see if I can explain this. George Bush's party controls the Senate with 55 votes. He was just elected recently. He should be in a strong position. His nominee should have little or no problems getting confirmed. And indeed, we saw that with John Roberts. You know, there were 22 votes cast against him, but pretty easy confirmation. So the fact that the president has had to withdraw a nominee is really rather stunning. On the other hand, given how this process has unfolded, how questions have been raised, both about whether Ms. Myers was qualified for the job, how her answers to questions posed by the Judiciary Committee were seen as inadequate, were all leading to this outcome. So the outcome, once the process started, wasn't surprising. But I think it's really stunning that President Bush nominated her in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, to get away from specifically Harriet Myers and the political events surrounding her nomination and the withdrawal of the nomination, I was indeed, when I saw this just not very long ago in the Tribune one morning, I thought, now this is exactly the question, or perhaps it should be the question, something that in a sense we're talking about, and yet certainly in the kind of hearings that took place for Judge Roberts, and no doubt will take place for the next person, probably will not come up. This very question of, well, let's set aside what a nominee thinks about abortion or about states' rights or about, you know, any of these other very volatile issues. It seems that the central sort of issue really is, well, What is the court all about? What is its function? What is its place in America? It is something that seems that we're debating, and yet does not come up in the course of these formal kinds of discussions with people that we're talking about sending to the court.
I think that's exactly right. You know, as your introduction, I think, put it quite well, so much of what will happen in the Senate with the next nominee is to try and pin him or her down on views about abortion and other issues. But that all assumes that it's appropriate in a democracy for this branch of unelected, electorally unaccountable lawyers to make fundamental decisions about how we live our lives. And nowhere in the Constitution is that explicitly granted. It was asserted by the court as a power early on, but the court has more or less over time been somewhat humble in its approach. In the last 10 years, the Rehnquist Court has been called the most activist court in American history. The late Rehnquist Court, say, from 1995 to 2003, has struck down more federal statutes than any previous Supreme Court in American history. And that does raise a question, is this a good thing?
Mm-hmm. You touch on something that I think is very interesting and also I find puzzling, that it seems that nowadays much of the criticism of courts, that criticism that says that uses the word judicial or the term judicial activism, that talks about the fact that here we have a bunch of, no matter what level courts you're talking about, well, particularly when it comes to the Supreme Court, an unelected body that is usurping the power of Congress, our duly elected representatives in Washington, the people that we elect to make laws, that we have this unelected body that's usurping their power, and that's wrong. And it seems that this criticism mostly comes indeed from the right side of the political spectrum, that it is conservatives being critical of activist judges. However, when you take a look particularly at the Supreme Court, as you have said and other people have pointed out, if your measure of activism is the tendency of the court to set aside the actions of democratically elected bodies, then this Rehnquist Court, not thought of as being a bunch of liberals, is in fact very activist. That then calls into question, well, when you talk about activism, what do you mean?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Traditionally, we had a view of what activism meant. And what it meant was courts invalidating the acts of democratically accountable bodies, the Congress of the United States, the state legislature of Illinois. And activism was seen as a bad thing. Traditionally, it was conservatives who supported activism and liberals who opposed it. And probably the clearest example of this is the first several decades of the 20th century, when courts tried to prevent government from regulating the economy. everything from minimum wages to worker safety to working conditions to pensions and the like. And so liberals rallied and railed against activism. Conservatives supported it. When Roosevelt was so successfully reelected in the 1936 landslide and threatened to pack the court switched, and they became great defenders of the kind of issues liberals supported. So what basically happened is liberals and conservatives switched sides, and they just handed each other their briefs, their arguments. Same arguments, they just changed words. But again, the point of activism was that it was countering Democratic majorities in legislatures. What's happened today, as you pointed out, is that the meaning of activism has changed somewhat. Again, President Bush and many people in the Republican Party complain they don't want activist courts, and they point to Justices Scalia and Thomas, for example. Turns out, since 1995, they have voted to strike down more federal laws than any other member of the Supreme Court. And indeed, who has voted the fewest times to strike down federal laws in this period? The two appointees of President Clinton, Justices Breyer and Ginsburg. So we have enlarged, if you wish, the meaning of activism. And let me just say one more thing. I don't mean to be talking this much,
that's good. That's good.
I live on the far south side in a usually quiet neighborhood, and I didn't get a lot of sleep last night. There was a lot of noise on that street. One of the points, though, is that critiquing the court for being activist is not a partisan issue. And what I mean by that is liberals and conservatives keep switching sides. So that suggests there's really a more basic underlying issue about what role is appropriate for the court in this democratic society.
It strikes me as that we may indeed now have gotten to the point where calling someone a judicial activist simply means that they've made some ruling that you don't like, and indeed we've become so careless with it that I wonder whether it's now gotten to the point where it doesn't really mean much of anything.
I think, unfortunately, you are correct that we really have denuded it of meaning and that we should probably talk more about what we like and dislike. But, of course, that is nakedly unprincipled, and people want to hide their preferences behind claims of principle.
In this part of Focus 580, our guest is Gerald Rosenberg. He's an associate professor of political science and lecturer in law at the University of Chicago. We're talking about the Supreme Court and its role in American government and society. He's the author of a book that touches on this that's titled The Hollow Hope: Can Courts Bring About Social Change? That book is published by the University of Chicago Press. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and questions are welcome. We have someone ready to go. Others can certainly call in. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, so if you're listening in Chicago, for example, or anyplace else, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. We do have a caller in Indiana. We'll get to here the first, and line number four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I have a question, but first a little dinky commentary. I remember as a youngster in junior high school, I was very idealistic. I remember I saw the court, large picture of the court, and the only way I can think of it is at that time I thought of them as Greek gods, and somehow they had their hand on truth. Well, since the times have passed and I lived through the 60s and all that good kind of stuff, I was out on the street a lot and doing this and doing that, I realized they're not exactly men with feet of clay. But God, there's such a difference than what the image that you're given in the school system and what actually is going down. The PR program to explain that this court is, or the past courts in particular, ones that were under Democratic presidents, were exceptionally radical and that they were changing laws that Congress made, and which, you know, for some reason, seems to be one of the things they actually are supposed to do is check out whether they're constitutional or not. I wonder if you can make some comment, if you would, about the PR program that's going on now from the radical right. Hopefully, I don't know if you're in that position, but if you're not, perhaps you can give some observations about it. And secondly, is the sort of way it's headed in this term, and I understand why the Democrats are real concerned about who's going to be on the court, and understand why the Republicans are real concerned about who's on the court. But are these kind of answering and question sessions that you mentioned are part of the Democratic process, do they have a bad end in some way? Are we getting close to somewhere, I wouldn't call it a stalemate, but where we're going to get people who are going to have to be so clean in some way or another that they are going to choose not to do a paper trail? And I guess Ms. Myers would be one of the best examples of that, of any person I've seen that's been brought up by anybody in power to be put on the court. As a youngster, I would think, I mean, my God, what is that woman doing there, you know, that sort of thing. I guess from my age, we're looking for people who have made some important contributions to jurisprudence. And that's the way I used to think of it. I know it's not that way, but I sure wish it were that way. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Okay, those were two very thoughtful questions, and I'm not sure I can give them the credit they're due, but I'll take a stab at it. Look, critiques of courts throughout American history have always been driven by partisans, and they're always about outcomes. So yes, in the 1960s, the critiques of the Warren Court were launched mostly by Republicans who disagreed with its race decisions, with decisions protecting the rights of criminal defendants, and the like. There's nothing new about that. It was the left that blasted the courts in the first few decades of the 20th century for supporting business against working-class, blue-collar Americans. So critiques of courts in this country have always been driven by ideology and partisan preference, and there's nothing new about that. I think we're living through a period in part where the right wing has been leading the critiques, but historically the left has done so as well. The second part of the question had to do with, as I understood it, the Judiciary Committee hearings and where are we going. Are we really at the position where the only person who can be nominated is someone who has never expressed an opinion on anything legal? Okay. And I think that's probably not true. For example, if you take Justice Ginsburg, who was nominated not that long ago, in 1993, she said publicly that she supported Roe v. Wade. Okay, she took a stand. She was confirmed by a vote of 96-3. So taking a stand does not necessarily mean that you will not be confirmed. Part of the problem, I think, with Harriet Myers is that she was perceived as not having the strongest credentials. And so that opened up the questioning of her beliefs. Justice Scalia, who was understood to be very conservative, now although he refused to take positions on even Marbury versus Madison, the 1803 case, where the court claimed it had the power to invalidate the acts of the other branches on the ground that they were unconstitutional. It's pretty much taken for granted that that's the bedrock of the court's power. It's 200 years old. He wouldn't take a stand on it. But he was confirmed 98-0. And in part, that had to do with an appreciation of his experience and background, the quality of his mind, but it was also political. There was a popular president, Ronald Reagan, whose party controlled the Senate. Part of what I think we're seeing today is that we have a weakening president. And a weakening president is not in a good position to push a nominee who is seen as or can be charged with being less qualified than his ideal. Now, perhaps that I said too much here. What I think I mean to say is that if the president nominates very qualified people who are not on the ideological extreme, I think they will be confirmed and pretty easily, although we will have this give and take on the Judiciary Committee.
All right. Questions are welcome from people who are listening. We're talking this morning about the Supreme Court and about its role in U.S. government and society. Our guest is Gerald Rosenberg. He is Associate Professor of Political Science and Lecturer in Law at the University of Chicago. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me also just mention for people who are listening that National Public Radio will be offering an hour of special coverage this afternoon on the withdrawal of Harriet Myers from her Supreme Court nomination, and we will air that beginning this afternoon at 1. So if you're interested in more analysis and conversation and discussion, you can tune in for that. Otherwise, here on the program, we're trying to talk in a bit more general terms about this larger issue, not so much specifically about Harriet Myers or about her nomination or about that process, but a little bit step back from it, in a sense, to look at this bigger question, which our guest says is not really discussed very much, and that is the question of what is the role of the court.
David, can I add a point here? I was
thinking about
the caller's kind of gut feeling, particularly as a child, that the justices were these masters of jurisprudential philosophy and the like. And I did a look a few weeks ago. I just got curious about what percentage of people who have been Supreme Court justices had served as judges before. Right? It might be some indication. And upwards of 40%, as they say, were not burdened by ever having served as a judge before. All right? Also turns out that a majority of the justices did not go to what we'd call prestigious law schools. Now, in part, that may be an artifact of the fact that there weren't very many of them in the 19th century. But typically a justice was, well, not typically, but it was not unusual for a justice never to have served as a judge before, to have not gone to one of the great famous law schools, but to be someone who is active in politics. And over the last few decades, we've moved away from that. We've moved more to nominating and appointing as justices of the Supreme Court people who've been federal judges. That may be leading, some critics say, to a professionalization of the court and to a court that believes it has the power and the right to play a very active role in striking down the actions of the other branches.
Well, it's obviously here we're dealing with a lot of history, and so to ask a question about the forces that shape the court is that's a big question. One could write very big books on the subject. But having said that, I maybe you can say something about that. For example, here now I'm looking at the section of the Constitution that talks about the Supreme Court, and it's
right.
Pretty short.
It doesn't
really say it for example, it doesn't say anything about what sort of qualifications a person should have to be on the
Correct.
Court. It doesn't say anything about that. It doesn't really say, you know, it says that the judges shall hold their offices during good behavior. And at stated times shall receive a salary, and that they can't get a pay cut during the time that they're in office. And then there's a section that talks about where the judicial power extends, which is very large and fairly general. And so this leaves an awful lot up to, well, I don't know what, to political process, I suppose, among other things, to determine, well, what should the court be? Who should be on it? What exactly should they be doing? And how do we even go about answering a question like that?
I think that's exactly right. The last time I counted, Article 3 of the Constitution, which creates the Supreme Court, has a total of 9 sentences. It is remarkably short, particularly compared to Article 2, or Article 1, I'm sorry, on the Congress,
mm-hmm.
which goes on for pages and pages and pages. And I think you're exactly right, David. What this suggests is that the role and power of the court will be decided politically. And that means it will also change over time. Indeed, when John Jay, who was one of the founders, one of the framers of the Constitution, He was an early Chief Justice. He steps down. In 1800, he's offered appointment again as Chief Justice, and he refuses it. Why? He refuses it because he says it's an institution that has no power, prestige, or authority, and will not play any important role in American politics. Now, that's a remarkable claim. Today, you know, we'd say, boy, this guy obviously wasn't very bright. But he was. Made important contributions to the Constitution. What he was reflecting, though, was an accurate description of the court at that time. It changed, and it changed in large part, I want to suggest, because it sided with then-growing political forces, forces of nationalization, forces supporting the federal government against the states. It reached a height, arguably, in 1937, when it was playing a different role, and that role was to limit the ability of government, as I suggested earlier, to regulate the economy. President Roosevelt, who was tired of seeing his New Deal policies struck down by the court, and who had just won what was at that point the greatest landslide in American history, threatened to pack the court. That is, he had a proposal to appoint one helper justice for every justice who I believe was over age 70, and that would have increased the size of the court from 9 to 15, which, as you point out, is entirely constitutional, because nothing in the Constitution speaks to the size of the court. Massive Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate. So it was assumed from the get-go that this or a similar bill would pass. What then happened is the court rethought the issue and changed its mind and basically backed away from regulating the economy. So we got a very different court after 1937. So I think the underlying issue, again, is what role do we, the people in a democratic society, want the court to play? And I don't think the answer is easy, and people may disagree, but it's a debate we ought to be having in a democratic society.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think part of our interest in trying to discuss some of these issues goes back a little bit earlier, a couple of months ago, when the Bar Association, the American Bar Association, decided to set up a commission on civic education. And the now retiring member, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and former presidential candidate and Senator Bill Bradley are going to head this thing up. And the reason that the Bar Association decided that this thing should be set up is that they conducted a survey and found that barely half of the adults that they surveyed could correctly identify the three branches of government, which seems a little shocking. But then, you know, now I'm starting to think, well, maybe even if you could name the three branches of government, I wonder whether, in fact, their relationship, that is, of the three branches to each other, is actually as clear as one might think.
You raise a couple of points. You know, of course, I think we're all stunned when we hear about these kind of surveys. And we actually have, oh, about five decades now, going back to the 1950s, of surveys on Americans' knowledge and understanding of courts. And to call the results abysmal would be kind. The lack of knowledge is just overwhelming. So, you know, a civic education project is probably a good thing. On the other hand, let's go back to the caller who talked about the idealistic vision he was given in school. I'm not sure that's helpful either, because, as you point out, relations between branches are not clear. And they're not clear because they change, and they change in part based on what it is the people through their representatives want. Now, they don't change willy-nilly. There are some boundaries within which they operate, but the relationships are not set in stone, and neither is the role of the court. And again, you know, as I mentioned in that op-ed page piece, do we want in this society a group of five lawyers. I'm taking the worst case, a 5-4 split decision, invalidating laws passed by a majority of the 100 members of the Senate, the 435 members of the House, signed by the president, all of whom are elected by the people. Is that what we want? Now, maybe the answer is yes. But when put in that stark terms, maybe the answer is no. And that's the kind of debate I would like to see the country engaging in, and it's not happening.
Let's bring some more callers into the conversation. We'll start with someone in Champaign, in I believe, and that's line number one. Hello?
Yes, very interesting conversation so far. I'm perplexed. I never hear people talk about this whole question of qualifications. If I'm going to go to a brain surgeon, I want to have somebody who's actually studied medicine. If I'm going to take my car to a mechanic, I want to have somebody who actually knows something about machines. Why is there this implicit assumption that it's perfectly legitimate to have somebody who is in charge of the law of the land, as it were, not necessarily know anything about it? You had mentioned the one objection or the one possibility that it might professionalize the court system. Well, it's already there. I mean, you just said that the surveys over the last several decades said that the civic knowledge in America has been abysmal for years and decades. So we know that it's already there. I can, as a private citizen, walk into any court in the land and represent myself without people raising eyebrows. And if I'm not mistaken, if I claim that I want to represent myself in just a regular court, our local municipal court, they're going to appoint an attorney to kind of keep an eye on me to make sure I don't do anything completely crazy. I certainly would never be allowed to speak in front of a state Supreme Court, let alone a national Supreme Court. So the court system is already professionalized. Why don't we hold candidates to important offices up to standards? When I work with people in business, you don't hire anybody who's completely unqualified for a job, or at least I should say, who doesn't have relevant experience relative to that job that they're interviewing for. So why is there even a discussion that it's fair and appropriate and it's even good that we consider people who don't have the relevant experience for a high court in the land? And I'll just see if you can pull something interesting out of that and list it offline. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Wonderful question and caller. I compliment you on the clarity and forcefulness with which you made the point. And I think I have an answer. It may not be one you're happy with. I am not arguing against knowledge. Knowledge is a good thing. I'm a professor. I believe in this. I am not arguing against standards or against relevant experience. The question I'm raising in part is, what is the relevant experience for being a justice of the Supreme Court? What ought the standards to be? Now, let me give you some examples. Let's say we think the role of a justice should be to look at the original understanding of those who wrote the Constitution, okay? Original intent. This is a position that some conservatives take. Well, if I wanted to know that, I would turn to a historian of constitutional America. I would not turn to a corporate lawyer or a business lawyer or even a civil rights lawyer. The historian will have studied this period in greater depth with better training and more tools. If I was thinking about what the right policy for abortion should be, with all due respect, a lawyer would be the last person I would turn to. I might turn to someone who studies ethics or morality. I might consult with a religiously trained person. I might consult with a medically trained person. So this gets back to what we think the Supreme Court should be doing. If it was simply a narrow court of law deciding narrow points, then I think the caller would be right. We try and identify the best legal minds. But so little of what the court does that the country cares about involves that I think if we are going to have a court continuing to act the way it has been over the last 40 or 50 years, we need a different set of standards. I wish the caller was still here to see what he thought of that. But, David, did that make any sense?
Yes, I think you did a pretty good job of responding to the caller. Indeed, he might not agree or might want to follow up, but We'll let it there, and we'll go on to pursue it with some other callers here. Line two is the next in line, and that's Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I understand Judge Posner has started a debate by posing the premise that democracy is not really about popular empowerment, but that it's just a mode of selecting different groups of elites to govern. And I was kind of curious as to what the position of the University of Chicago would be on that. And, quickly, and then I'll hang up. As to the what the Supreme Court ought to be doing, you didn't mention Article 6, and I hardly ever hear Article 6 mentioned, but that the idea that all treaties are supposed to be the supreme law of the land, I'm really curious how law colleges today are handling that, because it seems to me that's totally gone on the wayside, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Okay, a couple questions. The first had to do with the theory of elitist democracy, which the caller says my colleague Richard Posner, judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, is now pushing on his blog, I assume. I'm afraid I haven't looked at it. Let me say first, the University of Chicago has no position, right? We are a collection of, what, probably over 1,000 faculty members, 10,000 students. We are a contentious, difficult lot, and I would be hard-pressed to think we would take a position on theories of democracy. The elitist theory of democracy is not new, and again, as the caller correctly explained, it's a belief that really all democracy does is to elect smart people and get out of their way, let them govern. We, the people, just don't know enough to be able to contribute meaningfully, and when we do stick our big foot in the way, we mess things up because we're ignorant. This was a view that was probably made most prominently by a Austrian emigre to the United States earlier in the 20th century, a man named Schumpeter, who made this claim. Don't know quite what to say about it. Certainly wouldn't be my belief. It might, if you took that view, you might be then very happy with an activist court if you believed that its members were the super bright folks. That gets dangerously close to philosopher kings. You know, if only we had a really great, smart, wonderful person who could rule us wisely and justly, wouldn't it be a better world? Yeah, it probably would be. Problem is, what if we get it wrong? What if that person isn't so wise and just? So that, of course, is the problem with elitist democracy. David, I'm afraid I forgot the second part of the question.
Well, the caller was raising a question about Article 6 of the Constitution, and I'm here looking at it. Particularly, I think Gessie's interested in Clause 2 that says essentially that the Constitution, the laws of the United States, all treaties made under the authority of the U.S. shall be the supreme law of the land, and judges in every state shall be bound thereby. I'm not quite sure what it is about this that the callers really interested in.
Right. That was my question as well. It's known as the Supremacy Clause, and its major role has been to say, if we are going to be a nation, even though we are composed of 50 subunits, the states, we have to have uniform law on many subjects at least, and when the Congress acts and the president signs a bill, that will be uniform law. Hmm. Now, treaties are ratified by the Senate, and so the court has treated treaties as coming under the Supremacy Clause and therefore overriding contrary state and local law. But again, like you, I wasn't quite sure what the example was or the question was that the caller was raising.
Well, we do have some other callers here, and I want to get to them, and we have less than 15 minutes now left in this part of Focus, and I should introduce once again our guest, Gerald Rosenberg. He is Associate Professor of Political Science and Lecturer in Law interested in American politics and public law, are particularly interested in the use of the court and courts to further the rights and interests of the relatively disadvantaged. That certainly is a subject of his book, The Hollow Hope, Can Courts Bring About Social Change? It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think in the book you explain that it's your intent in the book to ask this question, are courts able to do that, not whether they ought to do that? But maybe I'd ask you the question right out, ought they to?
You are correct in characterizing what the book is about. It's a descriptive analysis of whether they are effective when they do, and whether litigants on the left should turn to courts as a strategy for producing the goals they want. Ought they to do it is a much tougher question. And it's a tougher question because on the one hand, if you believe in protecting and expanding the rights of the relatively disadvantaged, if you believe there are constitutional protections for them, then the court not only ought but must do that. On the other hand, if you think many of the questions that are brought are questions of values and morality, those are questions that should not be decided in a democratic society by a court, but by the people. So I am hopefully artfully dodging your question, David.
Very good. Well, I'll turn you now over to some of my colleagues here on the committee. They can question you next.
All right.
We'll go to Bloomington, Indiana. This is the next caller, and line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Rosenberg. In the course of researching for your book, did you ever come across the name Richard Harris, who wrote several articles for The New Yorker, and they were under the rubric Annals of Law?
Boy, you know, I actually don't remember. This book came out about a dozen years ago, and I don't know if that predates the Harris articles. I'm afraid I'm not familiar with them.
I was hoping that you did, and that you could advise me and other listeners who are interested in Supreme Court decisions if anyone had ever mined his articles that he had written for The New Yorker back in the 70s. Because they were just tantalizing insights into not only the amendments to the Constitution, but also how the Supreme Court has weighed in on these various topics, throughout the last two centuries.
Well, was there anything? I mean, can you give a kind of example, or was anything you could? Can you summarize what the point that the writer was getting at would be? Give Professor Rosenberg something to react to.
Okay. For example, and as you can recall, is the format of The New Yorker back in the old days. These were long articles,
mm-hmm.
and they were extremely well researched. And I wrote down several of these. There was an article that came out in April 12, 1976, and this was a portrayal of the Fifth Amendment in April 20th. That's April 12th. On the 25th of 64. There was an article penned, Legal Procedures, Right to Counsel, and these were Supreme Court decisions. In December 16th of 72, there was decisions on jury trial, Supreme Court decisions. And when I read these, I was as extraordinarily ignorant of the Supreme Court, probably as most of the students I was in school with at the time. And these were some knockout revelations, and very tantalizing in terms of how... there were actually three parts. What Harris did is he would actually take a contemporary issue, for example, a right to privacy, something that was going on, for example, in the Nixon court, and he would talk about the precedent of what had happened in earlier cases and track that back to the time of colonists and indeed track that back to the time of our forebears in England dealing with the various kings in Magna Carta and so forth. So he did this extraordinary, tantalizing investigations that were not only timely back then, but I suspect timely now, and that's the reason that I was hoping that you could tell me if anyone has a good insight to found this type of writing for people like ourselves to get a hold of?
And again, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with these articles. They sound like they were fascinating. Yes, there are a number of legal historians who really do try and understand the thinking behind various parts of the Constitution that may allow us to get a better sense of how narrowly or widely clauses can be interpreted and how they fit current circumstances. And so there's lots of writing on that. I can recommend two books that I particularly like. One is a book I teach all the time by Robert McCluskey called The American Supreme Court. And he was a professor of government at Harvard who studied courts and law. And this book came out in 1960, I believe. It's in its fourth or fifth edition. It was written for the kind of people your callers sound like, David. Mm-hmm. Intelligent, thoughtful, engaged, but not lawyers. And it's really a wonderful book. And another one on judicial review that spent a lot of time on the thinking of the founders came out, I believe, last year, maybe 2 years ago, from Harvard, written by Larry Kramer, who's the dean of the Stanford Law School. That's a very readable book as well, and that may help caller readers like your caller, although I'm afraid, not having read the Harris articles, I'm not sure that's precisely responsive to his question.
No, but your two suggestions on these two books were really helpful, because it's an extraordinarily torturous pathway to go through the libraries, and none of these New Yorker articles are accessible online. I mean, either you have to find some library that right. has the old bound issues.
Right. And, well, the McCluskey book, in its, again, most recent fourth or fifth edition, has a very helpful 10 or 20-page essay on readings.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be a very good place to start. It's in paper. You should be able to find it used, if not, then on Amazon pretty cheaply.
Okay, great. Thank
All
you.
All right, well, thank you for the call. Let's go to another caller. This is someone in Champaign County and line number 3. Hello.
While we're doing other book reviews, I don't know if you have a comment on People's History of the Supreme Court. It was the same guy that went on and released the audio from some Roe v. Wade and some other
Is that Peter Irons?
Yeah, indeed. It is, yeah.
Right. I'm afraid I haven't read it.
Well, it kind of breaks it down to how the court has affected people, and also the dynamics of the people in the court too, is showing the dynamics between Douglas and Superior Court.
I do know something about Peter Irons. He generally takes a heroic view of the court that has been a great engine of social change and protecting people's rights. I don't think the evidence supports that at all. So I would have to, maybe he treats it differently, but in his other work, in his other academic work, that's been the view he's taken.
I see. I'd like to think that it would. I'm sort of a preambulist in a way, and promote the general
right.
welfare,
right.
your domestic tranquility, those kind of things. And I think all units of the government ought to be doing that. So general welfare doesn't mean welfare for the generals. It means welfare for the particular people in the society as well. I wanted to know if you did any kind of cross-cultural kind of examination of how courts operate. I know that in some European courts, you need a supermajority to start with, so you wouldn't have this argument about cloture votes and that sort of thing. And I don't think that's even for lifetime appointments. But that's heretical to do, because we're we're the exception. America's the exception, and we shouldn't examine other people's jurisprudence. I forget which one was scolded by the Federalist Society. But this one more point about the meritocratic approach to this. You know, when you have people like in the Federalist Society who believe that this isn't a democracy, it's a republic, obviously anybody that didn't agree with that wouldn't have a very, very, you know, intelligent approach to the law. So it disqualifies anybody that has an approach that would be egalitarian and promoting general welfare, ensuring domestic tranquility, et cetera. If there's a line of people, I'll just bail out now. Thank you.
couple quick points. Thank you for those questions. I've done a little work on other countries. And, of course, what we're seeing today is change. Traditionally, within the Anglo world, that is, countries that came out of the English tradition, courts did not have the power to invalidate the acts of the parliament. There was parliamentary supremacy. Similarly, in the continental systems, courts lacked this power. That's beginning to change. Courts are being given more of these powers, and they're asserting them, and there's a lot of work to be done on what difference this has been making. There's a fascinating book, came out a couple years ago, by a professor at the University of Toronto named Rand Herschel, in which he argues that the attempt to empower courts does not protect the rights of the disadvantaged, but protects the rights of political elites and corporations, and this should be seen by people who care about equality as a move to limit it. It's a very controversial book. Finally, on the Federalist Society, a number of my colleagues are members, and people have very broad views. I don't think it's fair to tinge everyone who's a member of that society with being very conservative politically. I think that's not the case.
We're going to have to stop, having just opened the door a little bit on, into this whole subject in this debate. So I think we'd have to say that we'll, in a sense, put the conversation on hold and see if we can get at it in some different ways with some other guests in the future. But our thanks to our guest this morning for starting us into this conversation and starting us, giving us a chance to think about it. Gerald Rosenberg is Associate Professor of Political Science and Lecturer in Law at the University of Chicago. And again, you might be interested in his book, The Hollow Hope, Can Courts Bring About Social Change?, published by the University of Chicago Press. Professor Rosenberg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The broadcast today is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. The program is also made possible by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. That's it for us here on Focus 580. But we want you to stay tuned because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine and Celeste Quinn is the host. In the 1 o'clock, some more conversation about the court and current politics.
That's right. This afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll join National Public Radio for